Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 18th, 2018, and welcome to episode 168 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find
the RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, feedback, and feedback. It's a smaller table today. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined by Jack Nutting in Sweden. How's it going, Jack?
I'm pretty good, Paul. How about you?
It's pretty good. We have a very small table here, but we're also kind of doing kind of a functional episode, and just we're going to skip past the topic, and we're just going to go straight to like the million bits of feedback that we got. I don't know what it was about this last episode, but or maybe just things building up, but a lot of people wrote in, so thanks, that's cool. But it's going to take the whole time to talk about those.
People have a lot to say, so we'll just clear the inbox here.
Yeah, getting sort of moving toward inbox zero. But I don't think I've ever had, as long as I've had an inbox, it has never seen zero except like prior to setting up the computer.
I've gotten there. It was some work. It didn't last forever, but I've managed to like keep it pretty close to zero for the last couple of years now, actually, which is pretty weird. Like, cause for a time I got it up into like six digits of unread. I would have colleagues who would look, you know, glance my computer screen and say, wait, does that red badge say 142,000? Yeah, it does. So I've gotten better.
I don't trust the metadata that much anymore. Like unread versus read is a terrible flag because sometimes that'll just flake out on you and disappear. And I try to use, I still do kind of use the Mac mail added some sort of thing that allows for colored flags. So there's like a purple flag and a red flag or whatever. You can set them as labels.
Right.
But that also seems to be not too reliable.
I've never actually used those.
Yeah, I think just because
it always seemed, I always suspected that it would not be reliable.
Yeah.
So
I just need the world to stop for about 6 months while I reorganize everything, and then everything will be fine. I'll be very efficient after that.
You know what to me is much more important than inbox zero? Hamper zero. Like when I can get all the laundry, actually like all, like, and that, it also doesn't last long, right? Within like a minute, someone has thrown a dirty sock in there. But like when I get there, man, it's so good.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Right. Well, perhaps we can move on to the feedback here. Let's
see.
So
I can start. So we got an email from Andrew pointing out the fact that eBay is nice and all, but people ought to check out Shop Goodwill as well. There's a smaller audience, and so there's not, you know, there's not quite as much stuff on there, and not as many people looking at it either. So you have a pretty good chance of finding interesting items there. I've not really used this at all because, as far as I know, this is only in the U.S., maybe Canada, but I'm not there. So, you know, I hear people talking about buying things at Goodwill, and you know, I used to when I lived in the U.S. I would buy things in the actual stores. But yeah, have you looked at the Goodwill website at all?
I do check it occasionally, but I always forget. Mm. It's pretty rare, actually, to find something in an actual Goodwill anymore. I think they may have sort of like policies about old computers. Like you can get an old PS2 keyboard or whatever, but I never want those.
No.
So some of the Goodwill stores actually have eBay accounts as well. So I think Seattle does. And I've seen things through there, but actually at Shop Goodwill, I have gotten a few things. So I think I got a fairly rare Apple II disk drive that way. But right now when I'm searching for Apple II, I'm seeing nothing.
Okay.
So it's a smaller audience. There's a smaller amount of stuff there. People do look. So it's not like you will probably still be bidding against people. But,
right.
But if you wanted any number of Atari 2600s, this is the place to go. There's millions. I search for Atari and there's 83 results. Okay. Almost all of them, some form of Flashback or 2600.
Right.
Yeah, it's worth checking because there are occasionally things. Etsy, too, actually, is a place that I've found some kind of interesting things. Hmm. So it's worth keeping an eye on some of those other places, but they're smaller, and that's what you're going to find what you expect to find there. It's not all that much, not all that often.
Right.
Cool. Spencer sent email to point out and remind us about Tindy, which is a kind of like a front-end store site for electronics-related stuff. So there's a bunch of hobbyist-type boards and things are sold through there. So it's at tindy.com. And I went through and looked for a couple of things, and we'll have in the show notes some links to a couple of stores. So the RC2014 store has a bunch of these little components that you can use to put together, generally speaking, a Z80 homebrew computer with a bunch of different kind of like parts in sort of kit form. It's pretty neat. I think we've talked about these things before. And there's also Charles Mangan, who's been on the podcast before, has a bunch of his stuff up there in Option 8 is the name of the store, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's actually a pretty good place. If you have this kind of like kit homebrew stuff to sell, this is it's a pretty good platform.
Right.
It's probably not that different from Etsy, but it's sort of focused on this kind of electronics kit stuff.
So. Interesting. Yeah, I guess I've seen links to this before, and we have talked about some things on the site before, but I've never had a clear idea of what the actual focus of Tindy really is. But now that I see it, yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't have a lot of luck finding things on it. You know, I sort of specifically had to search for Apple and ZX and Commodore and things, and that brought up, you know, some of these stores that we'll have links to. And apologies to anyone whose store we didn't link to. I mainly linked to people I'd heard of, but so Tynemouth Software and GG Labs also there. Hmm. But it's a good place to look, and it might well be a good place to use if you are making such things.
Right. Cool. Well, I guess I can take the next thing. We got an email from Lauren, and I also saw this on Twitter somewhere. There's a new temporary exhibit at the Living Computer Museum Plus Labs in Seattle called Totally 80s Rewind. It already has opened and plans to close at the end of this year on December 31st. There's a classroom full of Apple IIe's. There's an arcade. There's a recreated sort of basement with board games, console games, LPs. on March 24th is going to be a party featuring an actual DeLorean.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So it seems pretty cool. It seems like it's, I think that, you know, there's a bit of 80s nostalgia going on in the culture otherwise in terms of shows like Stranger Things. And, you know, I think there are enough of us now who grew up in the 80s that many of us are looking back at our young lives and wistfully thinking of those old Apple IIe's and LPs and DeLoreans we never saw.
Right.
It seems very cool. And if I were in Seattle, I would go.
Yeah, this is it looks very, you know, it looks like I remember it, I guess I would say, you know. It is kind of funny that it's a little hard to capture, but somehow, you know, certain things do, like Stranger Things, I think, did a surprisingly good job of just getting the atmosphere right.
Yeah.
I'm really not quite sure what it is about it that they did, but
yeah, I think it was something about the kind of home environments that they created. Like, almost everyone could say, oh, I recognize, like I had that wallpaper, or I wore those tube socks, or whatever. Like, like they really sort of, like, got it somehow.
Yeah.
And this looks like, so it looks like they both, you know, they have, like, the classroom, they have the arcade room, which also is kind of, like, somewhat dimly lit, as arcades were at the time. You know, and you got your, looks like you got a Tempest and Ms. Pac-Man and Joust and a variety of things. I just really think that it's cool the way they sort of try to sort of take the kind of environment that many of us grew up in and make this into a museum environment. At the office where I'm working right now, they actually have one of these sort of Japanese arcade cabinets, and it's like this thing where apparently these are from the 90s, and they were just like single game units back when they were made. But over time, there's sort of an aftermarket of you buy a replacement board to slide in there that has 800 games or 1,000 games or whatever.
Mm.
And it's like an arcade cabinet, but it's sit down and with controls for two people, like two sets of joysticks and buttons. And one of the games that was on there was Golden Axe, which I remember playing in the arcade. And like I must have never continued very far because, you know, again, it was a thing where you had to pump quarters into it.
Right.
And I was sitting at that last week, the week before, with my daughter who was visiting me at work, and we started playing, and, you know, all there is in that is a button to simulate pushing in more quarters, so we could play all we wanted, and after just about two or three quarters worth, we actually completed the entire game. Like, it was literally about 10 minutes of gameplay, and it's like, congratulations, you won. It's like, wow. That's really weird. Like I had never imagined I was so close to completing it after a single quarter back in the day. You know, in those days when you had to pay for each one, you didn't know how big the game was necessarily. Yeah. And now it's like when you can just keep continuing forever, you can find that, oh, this thing wasn't very big. And I think it's probably unusual that they're as puny as that. But anyway,
do you think it was like on an easy setting or something, or do you think that really is just? It just wasn't that hard.
I think it just wasn't that hard, or just not that long. Just a very short number of levels. I don't know. It's pretty weird. Like, it had sort of a whole kind of ending sequence with, like, weird animations and stuff. And I thought maybe this was, like, a transition sequence. Like, okay, now we're going to get onto the next level. But it's like, no, congratulations, you won. It's like, okay. Different.
That's a little sad.
Yeah.
But, oh, well. Hopefully it didn't ruin your childhood.
No, it's fine. It was not like my favorite game or anything. But.
So Quinn wrote back after last time we were talking about the Oregon Trail handheld, and you know, I was beeping annoyingly into the microphone. And so on Hackaday, she pointed out that there, you know, there was relatively quickly a teardown of the Oregon Trail handheld, and so we'll link to that. Sort of goes through, and apparently it seems to be the NES version of the game. So not any of the sort of home computer ones, but still a 6502, I guess.
Yeah.
So there's what was it called again? There's a chip in there, a Famiclone chip.
Okay.
That is running this. And so I think both the point of the Hackaday article and the note that Quinn sent was that this is actually a super hackable little thing. You know, it's like a $25 machine. There's a fair amount of space in there, so you could put a Raspberry Pi Zero or other things in there.
Cool.
And, you know, all these pieces are... I think, at least as of the Hackaday article, they hadn't quite figured out how to drive the screen. But it does seem like this might be a pretty good platform for just doing other things with, you know. So maybe it wasn't such a bad thing that I bought two.
Right.
Because I can turn one of them into some other thing.
Cool. By the way, have you played it much?
Not since 2 weeks ago when I opened it. And, you know, I suspect that's probably going to be true for most people. I mean, you know.
Sure.
But it does, you know, save your game and stuff like that. I mean, like, it is, in principle, it's about as good as it could be.
Right.
I think.
And, like, what I see of this, like, the screenshots and things that I see are much more compelling than... Like, the only time I ever played the Oregon Trail was on, like, an Apple II Plus or IIe on a green screen monitor in school.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it looks way better. Like, there's so much more color on the NES version that this is, and, like, it looks interesting. It looks like there's much more to it than I remember. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and I think it also, the Apple II version was slow, and I really expect that the people of today, even the people who grew up yesterday, you know, like, what I mean is the people who had played the Apple II version, I suspect that a lot of them don't have the patience anymore for the speed that it went. So this does seem like it's a little zippier.
Yep. Cool. All right. Let's see. I'll take one of these. Oh, yeah. Ken, our own Ken Gagne, he suggested we look at this interview/documentary by Bill Winters for Guru Meditation, talking with Samia Halabi, who's an 81-year-old Amiga programmer. And this is really interesting. So she's a painter, she's an artist by profession, and 30 years ago started using the Amiga to make art. And it's both for, you know, in terms of the things that she does on screen, but also some of her actual painting art seems to be inspired by some of the kind of random artwork that she's come up with. And I haven't watched the whole video. I kind of skimmed through it. But what I gathered is that the way that she uses the Amiga is similar to how people use things like processing today to kind of sort of generate pseudo-random art that's going to be a little bit different every time. And really quite fun. And she seemed to still have her setup going there. I didn't quite catch what languages and tools she was using. It may be in there somewhere. But I didn't get a chance to look at this until right before we were going to start. I meant to look at it before and didn't. Just been that kind of weekend. But
yeah.
But I'm going to keep this tab open because it looks like a very cool thing. And she's still going strong, still apparently using her Amiga and still painting and making art. So
yeah, it looks like a neat video. I also, you know, it's 9 minutes long, but yet nevertheless, I didn't locate those 9 minutes before hitting record.
Exactly.
And I did hit record. But it's neat that they're doing this. I mean, so I actually, this is on the Guru Meditation channel, and I'm not actually sure. I'm aware of this as an Amiga outlet. And I think they, you know, they go to the VCFs and stuff like that. And,
mm-hmm.
It's neat that they're doing this interview, and I'm hoping that they will, you know, sort of continue to interview people like this. Cause I could easily imagine this person being someone who, you know, we could have never heard of.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I think it's great that they're reaching out and finding people who are using interesting old computers in ways that are not the things that we normally think of, you know?
Yeah.
Very cool. And again, like you said, I've come across this channel now and then, but I have not really followed it and don't know enough to see sort of what their kind of red thread is here. But they seem to have quite a broad spectrum of topics that they're talking about. So,
all right, let's see. So the next bit of feedback I will mention is, so we have a RCR podcast Facebook group that gets mentioned at the end every time. And recently, Bruce has been posting there some stuff about this Interact family computer that he had. It's his first computer from 1979, and I guess it was in the attic or something like that. And so he's getting it out and trying to, you know, he has a bunch of tapes he's trying to archive and just trying to get the thing working again. And so that's kind of neat, just kind of like following along with that. I'm glad that we're able to do this. It's a computer that I believe few people have heard of.
Yeah, I did not think that I've heard of this at all. It seems totally foreign to me.
Yeah, I don't know when I came across it. It's possible that, you know, it was just an eBay thing. You know, I've got an eBay search on for these. I think, you know, it's very early. So first of all, I'm not actually sure I understand the models, because I think they have several things that are called like the Model 1 or the Interact 1 or something like this. But anyway, it looks kind of cool. It has a like a tape deck built in and a kind of interestingly slanted keyboard, and the box looks kind of nice. So Bruce on the Facebook page has the box and shows a picture of it. And anyway, I'm interested in it just generally, and I'm glad that we're having a chance to see it. And also, it's a plug for our Facebook group. So
right,
that's good. Thanks.
Yeah, cool. It's always good when people show up with things that none of us even know what the hell it is.
Right.
So, so yeah, I'm excited to see more of this.
Yeah, and we wish him luck, and hopefully that actually is a great thing that he's trying to archive these tapes, because who knows how many other, these may be the only ones or the last ones. So.
Yep. Yeah. Who knows? You never know. The next one here. So Eric posted on Facebook about the TI-99 ETPEB prototype, and ET stands for Eric's Tiny PEB.
Yeah.
And I admit that I think that none of us sitting here today are truly experts on the TI-99 and know what's going on in that world at all. But it seems like a cool add-on in terms of being able to sort of have something with an SD card to load cartridges from, provide some RAM and a serial port. A virtual serial port of USB. There's an ARM coprocessor. I don't know. I think that if it looks like it's a pretty interesting add-on for the TI-99. I can't say anything more intelligent about it than that, but if you're interested in this, we have a link, and you should go and take a look.
Yeah. I think the on the Facebook page, Eric had shared like a picture of him holding it up in Rome for some reason.
Right.
but yeah, so there is the PEB is the peripheral expansion box that like this big thing that you put cards and stuff in, or I don't know what you call them in that context, but
right.
You know, it holds the expansion stuff in there.
That monster like outrigger cabinet
right.
for the TI-99.
Which is possibly better than like the parade of sidecars that you could also get before that. But the TI-99 is it has lovable idiosyncrasies, I guess.
Right.
If you read through this development of the ETPEB, it's pretty intense. I mean, like, it's a pretty deep dive if you want to read through this whole thread. But the end point of it is that I think it is getting pretty close to done.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
Okay, it's me now, right? Oh, yes. Okay, so Blake wrote on Twitter, because basically this has now turned into a series of podcasts about the CC40, the TI-CC40. But...
I never knew I wanted one until the past month, and now I really want one. The more we talk about it, the more I want one.
I know. It's. I sort of felt like that as well. but okay, so to recap, the CC40 occupied this weird space between a calculator and an impressive calculator and a kind of rather pathetic, in a sense, computer. and it had this connection, this hex bus connection that is in fact kind of a precursor to USB. It was supposed to be kind of plug and play, and the individual devices on it would identify themselves with a number, and you could address them and stuff. And the CC40 had the hex bus interface, and there are a few things that worked with it, but the main thing that never quite got released was the storage. So the obnoxious thing about this machine is that you can't actually sort of communicate with the outside world in any way. And so, so what Blake wrote to alert us to was the fact that actually after TI shut down the computer division, the calculator division basically took the CC40 and made a calculator version of it. So the TI-74 or the TI-95 calculators are essentially just the CC40, but in smaller form. But the interesting thing for this purpose is that they also had a hex bus interface. So the pins were laid out differently, but you can build an adapter to do this.
Okay.
So then you can use on your TI-74, you can use all the TI-74 accessories or CC40 accessories or vice versa.
Right.
So now even more cool. I want these things.
Right. So I guess there were more accessories made for these later calculators is the upshot of this.
Yeah, I think they're probably a little bit more accessible. And there definitely was a cassette adapter, which, is a big thing for the CC40.
Right.
So also Gregory chimed in on Twitter to point out that there are actually multi-carts that are being made / discussed at Atari Age. And there's kind of like a subdomain. It's not there's a subdomain that you can go to on Atari Age, which will redirect you to a part of the forums that's kind of specifically about TI-99 stuff. So it's at ti99.atariage.com.
Right.
So I have to say, I stayed away a little bit from Atari Age early on because I didn't think this was, the place for me.
Right.
but it turns out Atari Age is actually the place for everybody.
Right.
That's a good place for TI-99 stuff, but there's also all kinds of other stuff going on there. So definitely check that out if you haven't been there.
It's because Atarians are open, friendly people, Paul.
I'm sure.
We welcome all people into the fold.
Right.
We're a big tent.
Yep. It's a great site. I mean, it's one of the more active forums out there. So
yeah, definitely. It's actually, there's a ton of stuff there.
But I keep interrupting myself. But so Gregory wrote to point out that he did a demo on YouTube just recently using the Memo Processor cart, which also has kind of like modem communications on it, and the Hexbus modem that he has for the CC40. And so he made a little YouTube video about calling a BBS, and that's kind of interesting. Of course, it's like a one-line display, so it's actually kind of a rough call. But
right,
and challenging. there's a multi-cart thing, you know, so you don't have to have all the individual hardware carts for the CC40. You can sort of load stuff onto those. And there is a kit that you can get, a PCB, and build it. And Gregory is building some to sell, you know, built ones. And I'm looking forward to those because I know that if I got the PCB, I would never build it.
Right.
So, but anyway, so I think if there's enough interest, then perhaps there will be more of these. But they are, I mean, the PCB is like absurdly cheap. I mean, if I remember right, it's like $3 or something to, you know, the base cost of getting the PCB. Right. If you want to buy all the parts and put the thing together yourself, it's not super complex. Anyway, I'm continuing to fall down this hole.
You just can't help yourself.
Yep.
I understand. I get it. All right. I'll jump on to the next thing. Just a very quick note. Matt wrote on Twitter to say that it looks like there is a bit of analog TV still being broadcast. He said there is a low power holdout in Chicago. He referred to something called Banders ENTV on YouTube. We haven't really gone into finding out what this is all about, but it seems that someone is still broadcasting analog TV in or around Chicago. So,
Yeah, so I think Earl a couple times ago had wondered if, like, at the point of the digital switchover, if anybody was still doing analog TV.
Yeah, like, I remember we were talking about it, and I've looked at this this channel a bit on YouTube, Banders ENTV, or Banderson TV. I don't know.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. My guess is that it might be like B. Anderson TV.
B. Anderson TV. Hard to say.
Yeah.
I'm going to call it Banderson.
Banderson V.
It seems to be a lot of videos showing pieces of old analog equipment being restored, rebuilt, and things.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like that kind of stuff, looking at old TV, radio, analog things, there's some cool looking stuff here. But I don't know what this has to do exactly with whatever is happening in or around Chicago. But
right,
there are nice sort of pictures of like switches and CRTs and funky stuff. So that a lot of vacuum tubes.
Yeah, I sort of picked a video at random and kind of like watched a little bit of it, and you know, it does seem to be basically like troubleshooting these ancient black and white televisions and trying to bring them back to life, and you know, watching them thinking, oh, you're like I would never go anywhere near all of those pieces because I'm scared to death of like shocking myself.
Right.
And he's just playing around in there. I'm sure he knows exactly what he's doing, but
yeah.
Yeah, I think so. From what I kind of gathered about the analog digital TV thing, that they basically forced everybody to go to digital at a certain point, except that there were some exceptions for lower power stations.
Okay.
So that may be why, you know, why is a low power holdout in Chicago?
Right.
Like I thought maybe what was happening was the guy repaired the TVs and then tuned in a local station or something. Mm. Although I heard maybe something on the video that I was watching that made me think that he was actually just doing a like in-house broadcast from his digital signal.
Right.
So
yeah, that could be as well.
So maybe that's a super low power holdout where you have to be like on the guy's porch to get it.
Anyway. That's still allowed. Porch casting is still okay.
Yeah. However, anyway, the channel's pretty cool, even separately from
the right
analog
absolutely
stuff. Oh, okay. So I'll mention this. I don't know if it was last time, a couple times ago, maybe. Maybe it was last time. I mentioned the 40th anniversary of the Call Apple organization. So what we were mentioning specifically was that they had their latest issue was kind of covering their 40th anniversary. So Brian wrote to remind us that it in fact is not all about that. I mean, it's a regular issue, but it's got some extra stuff in it about the 40th anniversary. So it has the usual array of articles on various other things. So if we left the impression that it was just, you know, specifically about the 40th anniversary, it's a regular issue. And that actually may also be worth mentioning, too, that in case you missed it, it has been back for a few years now. I think several times a year since 2015, there have been PDF issues in the magazine produced, and those are available to Call Apple members, which the membership is currently just under $28. So So there, it's still, and you know, it's still being produced as a magazine. So if you didn't notice that it had come back, it didn't just come back for the 40th anniversary. It's been going for a little bit, you know, ramping up to that. So, but it's very good. Check it out. There's membership in the Call Apple user group. Actually, does it gives you access to the magazine, but also to back issues and some other things. You can read on their site what the member benefits are. Anyway, that's that. Thanks, Brian, for for reminding us to clarify that.
So I think our last item of feedback here is that Matt wrote on Twitter to mention Macrofab, which is a company that seems to do at least part of what we've been talking about. The past few episodes, we've been talking about the possibility of having a company that would do sort of prototyping and creation of your electronics designs in terms of being able to take a PCB design and actually assemble the components and all this sort of thing. And they seem to have some of this in place. I'm sure there are problems with it. I'm sure, you know, as Quinn detailed and our other listeners have emailed about the various difficulties of making this sort of thing work, you know, I'm sure that there are a lot of caveats here, but that probably for some things, this seems like a decent way of trying to start things out. You can upload your files and you'll get an instant quote and prices for numbers you want to order. And they have a very slick website anyway.
Yeah.
Say that. I feel confident about the website. It looks beautiful.
Yeah. Although that almost is a little bit scary in itself, but yeah. Yeah, no, it seems like they have, so there's some prototyping stuff to help you with that, and then there's larger scale fabrication, and actually I think, you know, also like delivery, you know, customer interaction stuff as well. The question I had when I looked at it was basically like how big are they expecting you to be? Because I still kind of feel like it's aimed toward people who are going to sell thousands and thousands rather than, you know, dozens of whatever it is.
Right.
But
yeah, it's hard to say. Like there's a screenshot showing someone having uploaded a PCB specification and specifying what they want in terms of colors and things. And there it does show the quantity one and a price for a quantity of one. So it looks like you can choose one as your quantity, but I don't know. But apparently you can actually here, you can just upload your Gerbers and your bill of materials and get an instant quote. So it could be interesting for someone who is in the process of doing this to at least sort of try it out from that point of view and to sort of see how it goes, you know. Mm-hmm. What do they promise you? What do they say in terms of pricing? How does it compete with others? I'd be interested to know.
Yeah. So if anyone's tried it that's listening here, I'd be curious to know, you know, what the actual result was. They actually also have a podcast I came across, which I have not listened to more than about 40 seconds of. but it might be interesting, you know, sort of about building stuff, basically, is what I understand it to be, you know. So it's not just a podcast of infomercials, as far as I can tell. It's actually about, right, like, you know, putting electronics together and stuff like that. I can't vouch for it being good, but it seems like it might be.
Right.
So, hopefully they're not just defensive or something. But it didn't look like it. It looked interesting, and I might try to listen to a little bit of it. But it's the little bit that I did listen to kind of presumed that you knew a bit more about electronics than I do.
Right. It's one of those things where if you're in the target audience, you know when you hear it. And if you're not, you also know when you hear it.
Yeah, right.
It's like, yeah, this is not mine.
Right. Yeah.
This is for someone else, not me. That's fine.
The little bit I was listening to had to do with how they put all their something or others in sequence on the power rails, and they had to put in some kind of capacitors to keep them from, you know, whatever, interacting, and I don't know. I almost followed it almost to that point, and then I started getting lost completely. So, okay, so that's the feedback, I guess. Thanks, everybody. We will now sort of continue on with very similar-seeming items of interest and news that we didn't get over feedback. Oh, no. Actually, some of them we did get over feedback, so whatever.
Okay.
Jack, do the next thing.
All right, the next thing. I found this video titled An Astonishing Old Calculator. This is on the Numberphile YouTube channel, which is quite interesting in itself. And here the host of this, a guy named Cliff, is explaining his passion for two Friedan EC-132s. This is an electronic calculator, like a desktop electronic calculator, which It looks a lot like something we've talked about recently, but I can't think of what it is. But it's the kind of thing that looks like, you know, the size of, say, the size of an Apple II, but it's just a calculator with a little screen, little CRT screen in there. And it can do calculator stuff. The nice thing about this video is he kind of does sort of a teardown and explains what the pieces are. He's talking about circuit boards, and it looks like at some point it was not quite working quite as well as it should have. Something was off with the display, but he got it working. And it seems to be able to calculate some numbers with a very high degree of, what do I should say, a lot of digits. Just showing a huge number of digits. And it has things like a built-in square root button, and probably has some sort of RPN way of working, so it's got like a stack and things. Seems kind of cool. I've never tried one of these out, but it was an interesting video, just partly just because the guy is so excited about it.
Yeah.
And he's opening up, and he's pointing out, like, whenever someone has opened this up and looked at it or worked on it, they've written a little note in there. Like it says, you know, somebody wrote, put this together in 1968, someone else looked at it in 2006, someone else looked at it in 2013. Sort of interesting, there are little sort of notes inside the machine. So,
cool.
Worth looking at.
Yeah. It's another 9-minute video. You can probably find that time. All right. Let's see. So I will move to the next thing. There's a series by Alan Huffman on Vintage is the New Old called Make Basic Fast Again. And so I haven't fully read through it, but it's kind of a neat concept, which is in a modern context, going over kind of optimization techniques for BASIC. So it's kind of focused on Cocoa BASIC specifically, but that is a Microsoft BASIC, and so a lot of these things sort of carry over to all of the places where Microsoft BASICs are found. So the Apple II, the Commodore, you know, 64, Commodore PET. I don't know, it's all over the place. IBM PC, I guess. Maybe that's not too surprising. But there was a thing, maybe I should try to find that again. There's a thing I did. Well, one of the things that Microsoft BASIC, the way it's organized is that at the beginning of every line, there's a pointer to where the next line starts in memory. Mm-hmm. And there was some kind of weird thing I did where you make like a 4-line BASIC program or whatever, and then you like poke in some magic value to point the next line over a line so that mm-hmm. when you list it, you don't see the line anymore, because as it lists, it just sort of, it prints out the line and then uses the pointer to find the next line. So if you fake it out and have it skip over, then it won't list the line, but if you run it, it'll still run. So it was kind of an interesting little exercise in like playing with, you know, like confusing BASIC with the pointers to the next line. But right. The cool thing is it worked on all these platforms. You know, like the exact same poke actually I think worked on the Commodore 64, and you could make an analogy for it for the PC and for the PET and stuff. So somewhere I have this kind of like ridiculous set of photos of this black magic with BASIC and all these computers. But anyway,
crazy.
I'll link to something because I think I talked about it before. Back to this. So essentially what's happening here is just kind of like looking at techniques that you can use to speed BASIC up, because BASIC is kind of slow.
Right.
So it kind of starts off by setting up a kind of benchmarking program that sort of determines like, you know, what's going to go faster. And the kinds of things that are investigated are like, what's the effect of having a comment, you know, what's the effect of having spaces, and what's the effect of like using for next loops or go to or go sub longer and shorter variable names and things like that. So a lot of this stuff is kind of, it's as you would expect, that if you know, removing the spaces and removing the comments does speed things up, but in a certain respect,
right.
It makes it run faster. It makes it take much longer to debug.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it's interesting to see. I mean, I remember learning a bunch of these kinds of things for the Apple BASIC, you know, AppleSoft, Microsoft mm-hmm. BASIC. So like, I think, in for next loops, if you say like for I equals 1 to 1,000, you can say next I, but you can mm-hmm. also just say next. It understands, you know, that you must have meant next I.
Right. Right.
And I think that speeds things up a little bit. Well, actually, also, if you want to use go to or go sub, either one of them, I think the way it determines how to find, you know, like how to know where to leap, is to scan from the beginning of the program down. So you always want to have, you know, your subroutines should all be right up at the top if possible.
Interesting.
And no one ever programmed that way.
No.
It's always like, you know, go sub 50,000.
Yeah.
Whatever. Actually, I don't know if you can go that high. There's some limit. 10,000 for sure.
The idea is cool to sort of take a look at something that is kind of pervasive, was on a lot of platforms, Microsoft Basic, and sort of figure out, okay, here are some commonalities these have, you know, things that if you do the right way, you'll get a faster program than you would have otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And I think a number of these things were known by their niche, you know, communities, but not,
sure.
not, I mean, this is now on the web, making it accessible in a fairly public way. And so I'm sure there are tricks that I didn't know.
Right.
So maybe there, but I didn't know that. I wouldn't have known that they worked on the Cocoa.
So, right.
So anyway, cool. Take a look at that if you can.
All right. I'll get the next one here. Retro Challenge. Next one is coming up in April. This is the RC 2018/04 competition. Now is the time to sign up if you want to sign up. And there is a rules page. The idea is the same as always. Basically, do something interesting with an old computer and blog about it for a month. But whatever you're going to do, you should send an email to John Linville first and describe it. And Vintage is the New Old is offering their website as a platform for your blogs. If you don't already have a blog, a place to post your stuff you're doing, your vintage thing, you can get it on there. So that's really nice. Because, mm-hmm. you know, not everyone is set up to, you know, not everyone has a blog already. Not everyone has a place to post their things. And now with this, you have one less excuse because you can do it easy and free on Bitno. Are you thinking about doing anything, Paul, this time?
I am always thinking about doing something, and I rarely ever get past that.
Yeah, me too.
April. Let's see, April. Yeah.
It's coming up.
I don't know. Maybe. It's. I think it's better than... I think it used to be in January, and that was terrible. That was like I never could find any time in January. This April, there might be a chance. All right, let's see. So how did I find this? I think somebody must have emailed me, and I didn't mark down who it was. So thanks, whoever emailed this. But it's a YouTube video called The Story of Tetris by Gaming Historian. And... you know, at first when I saw this, I thought, oh, well, you know, this is... I didn't realize that this was kind of a new thing, but it is kind of a new thing. This was published on February 2nd, so just over a month ago. So it is not a, like, big-budget documentary thing. I would say that it is amateur, except that it is very well done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, like, so amateur in the positive version of that word.
Right.
But, and it's... So it's, you know, it's well-constructed, and it talks quite a bit. I mean, so I didn't, you know, as is the norm for YouTube videos that we promote, I have not watched it, but I have watched pieces of it, and it is impressive, well done, and the pieces that I did watch, I didn't already know about. Have you seen any Tetris documentaries?
No, I've not seen any.
Okay.
I clicked through this one a little bit. Yeah, I agree. It looks good. It looks like it's well done in terms of, like, production quality. So, yeah. I might give this a watch. This one is not just 9 minutes, though. It's 59 minutes.
Yeah, right. So it's a bit of a commitment. But I think, I imagine there's a segment of the, you know, listening population that knows the story cold. I wasn't in that segment. And so it was interesting to hear about the people that were kind of behind the game and early versions of the game. Like, it came from some kind of Pentominoes game that was, you know, it was made slightly simpler by making things 4 instead of 5. And the original version of the game was just like making these pieces fit together in a puzzle and then you were done. And that didn't seem like it was as interesting as it could be. And the next version of the game had them falling, but that was it. You know, like they would just fall until you ran out of space. And it was the addition of the removal of a line when you complete it that basically like turned this thing into an addictive monster.
Right.
But yeah, anyway, so it's I would recommend that all of us, including me, watch it.
Yep. Yeah, it's always good to see sort of stories that show the progress of something, the progress of an idea. When we see something like Tetris, we see a ready-form game that it's not clearly, I mean, yeah, you can see some of the influences in terms of being a puzzle, but it's interesting to sort of hear the story of how people got from one step to the other to end up with something.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably the part that I find most interesting. I expect that later on I will hear about, you know, how the creators got kind of shafted, that kind of thing. But that wasn't the part I watched. So,
no.
Let's see. I guess there's one more thing that I'll mention quickly. I'll take it, although I think it is it's rightfully Michael's because he sent it in. But he wanted to point out that you can download a thing called eSheep version 1.0.2. It's an implementation. Let's see. It's what does it require? It'll run on modern Windows. So this is probably of particular interest to people who can kind of remember Windows 95. because what it is basically this little sheep that will like run around on your taskbar. And
right.
I assume you've seen these, right? These kind of things.
I don't think that I have, actually. I looked at the website for this, and it does not seem like anything that I remember seeing at the time.
Oh, okay. I think this was kind of like a genre.
Okay.
You know, like, so one that I recall, I mean, it may just have to do with kind of the coincidences of who I knew that ran Windows or whatever, but I remember a cat that would run around on your desktop mm-hmm. and, you know, sort of like stop and, you know, preen or whatever, and then walk around some more and chase things. And okay. And I think the sheep is kind of like that. It'll just sort of like meander about. So it's kind of like an animated backdrop of some kind. But, you know, so the actual, you know, the old one doesn't run anymore on Windows 7, 8, 10. But you can get this re-implementation if you want to see it go. So,
okay.
I don't know. It's whimsical enough that that I could imagine that if I ever went to running Windows, I might do that.
Yep, nice.
So I guess that's it for the items of interest and news. And so now a word from our sponsor.
I see by your job application you've scored 6 million on the video game Munchman.
Yeah?
And I see you shot down 2 billion aliens from the planet Mongo.
Yeah.
You are good at computer games. So what do you know about computers?
If you're going to spend your time playing video games, why not play them in something that can also teach you about computing? Get a Commodore VIC-20. It's tough to grow up in a computer age without learning about computers.
And we're back. I guess since I keep being host, someday I'm going to not be host. But since I keep being host, I keep being responsible for the gift idea. And so this gift idea is a $18 Microsoft Paint enamel pin. I saw this. Somebody had, I think it's at DOS Nostalgic on Twitter, had posted a photo of him holding one of these, which made me think, that's pretty cool. So it's basically just a little pin. It actually has a kind of like a whiteboard part on it that you can write on. But it basically just looks like that's probably a Windows 95 era window that is represents an untitled document in Microsoft Paint. Microsoft Paint, the lovable program for crappy art, it says. I think it's just very pleasing. It's in color. I think that's actually probably what makes it cool, is that it's 3 inches by 2 5/8 inches metal alloy with 3 pins on the reverse side. Actually, I didn't look at the 3 pins on the reverse side.
It seems like it looks very cool. It seems enormous. Like you could not. This is not like a lapel pin, unless you wanted to sort of like tear the lapel off of your blazer, because it seems just huge.
Oh, you think it's heavy too?
And it's probably heavy. I mean, it's got 3 pins to hold it on, right? So it must be something.
Oh, yeah.
You got to really sort of plant this onto something, I guess. Right. So.
But, yeah, that's true. It does look pretty big.
But it looks cool.
It does. Yeah. I do quite like it. If you like this, but not exactly this, there's a slightly less retro one that you can get a Photoshop one that you can sort of see in the related items and there's some other stuff. So.
Yeah, there are a few other ones. They also have like a recycling bin. It's like a Windows 95 recycling bin, and they have a beach ball, like as in the spinning beach ball.
Ah.
Doesn't spin though, but it's a beach ball.
I like it. I like the concept, but I hadn't seen it yet. Here it is.
Yep.
Beach ball pen. Oh, that's even cheaper. Oh, I want one of those. There's something that I really love about the fact that that thing that, that makes you angry when you see it is still left over from the next.
Yeah. Yep. But it's interesting because it's also, I like the evolution of it because back in the day on the next, it was very clearly representing a spinning, like, optical disc.
Right, right.
Like, either, like, think of it as a CD or as maybe the magneto-optical disc that was in the next machines.
Yeah.
And over time, like, sometime after Mac OS X came around and people started calling it the beach ball, is when they adapted it to make it actually more spherical looking.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about it, but you're totally right that it was obviously a disc, like a CD or something.
Right. Yeah. And people who, then I guess when it got to a wider group of people, people started seeing it as a beach ball, and then they made it into more of a beach ball.
Well, I think we'll put the link to that one in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
Though,
we gotta.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, we can go to the eBay auctions, and our lists are not well balanced, but you
no,
have
that's
one.
Okay. I have one. I at least have one. I have what I would describe as a very well-loved Atari Lynx. And if you look at the photo of this, you would see why. Basically, it's an Atari Lynx from back in the day, and these had sort of a dark gray, like gunmetal gray color. And someone has held this and played this so much that the side edges of the device and a lot of the spaces around the buttons, like all of the outer paint, is just completely worn away. And so when you look at it closely, there's clearly two layers of paint. The outermost layer of paint is dark gray. Under that is a lighter gray. And under that is just the white of the plastic. So there's an interesting sort of gradation of like dark gray to lighter gray to white on the edge of this thing. And it's, yeah, I mean, someone has liked this a lot.
Yeah.
Someone has played this a lot. I kind of like that. And right now, it's up for a week, and the current bid is €1, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The photos show that the screen looks kind of washed out, so maybe that's part of why it's as cheap as it is. Plus, I mean, it's far from new condition. It's like it's very, very worn on the edges. But I don't know. I might have to try and bid on this thing.
Yeah, it is. You know, so the paint's gone, but I'm trying to figure out if it's even eroded a little bit. You know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, is the actual plastic also been worn down? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Was this person's hands made of sandpaper? I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, if you wanted to get one to use it, it should not sell for a lot. Like, it ought not to sell for a lot.
Right.
But it is pretty cool that it still works, and kind of sad the person's getting rid of it.
Yep. I mean, yeah, there are definitely more beautiful Lynx units to be bought, but there's something I kind of love, the, like, you can see by how the wear patterns that, like, my God, someone sat with this for so long. Someone spent so many countless hours playing something on this.
Yeah.
Like, if I believed that a device could hold some sort of, like, psychic love value based on how much it's been used by a person's hands, like, this thing is full of love.
Right.
I don't believe that, but if I did believe it, this would be it. This is, like, the epitome of a well-loved thing.
Yep.
It's like a, you know, really ratty shoot-up teddy bear or something.
Right. But with less risk of, like, you know, some sort of insect.
Right.
Living in it.
Yeah, I do not think you will catch lice from this device.
All right. Cool.
So, that's me.
All right, so I have a little list of things. Most of them are minor, but so I came across a listing for it's Apple rubber bottom case feet. They're black little foam, actually rubber things, mm-hmm. they're the feet that go underneath a certain set of Apple products. So these are black. I think I forget exactly which ones have the black feet, but so if you want to replace yours, you can do this. I think a set of four is basically $18, buy it now, free shipping, at least in the US. So I guess largely I think of these eBay auctions as discussion
right.
topics rather than, because of course a lot of times the auctions are over by the time the thing gets posted even. But sure. Certainly anyone who listens to it, listens to us talking, you know, sometime further than a week after we recorded it, who knows. But so these I think will still be listed, but I wonder about this because they are genuine case feet from Apple computers, it says. They are black in color and come from later generation Macs, so they are not the gray feet. And in fact, I think there are also some things that had kind of like a white or off-white feet as well. So they are ideal replacements if your feet are missing or damaged, it says. And I don't believe that. I mean, like, I do believe that they are original feet. I don't believe that they are necessarily an ideal replacement, though, because, I mean, the reason you would need to replace these is, you know, A, if they just fell off and you lost them, that, you know, that's not a big deal. But a lot of them just turn into, like, chewing gum or whatever. Like, I'm sure you've run into this, right?
Yeah, yeah. Where they just, like, become sort of like a smeary rubber thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, you know, they'll stick to everything.
Right, and leave marks on tables and...
Yeah. Horrible, horrible. And, you know, I guess it's like some sort of the chemical composition of them, you know, somehow they have returned to their original goop. And so, I mean, the first thing I thought was, why in the world would you pick it? Why would you pick an old foot to put back on your computer? Because you know this is going to happen to it. But my sort of second thought, just after having that thought, is, well, maybe these are the ones that survived. Like, maybe they don't have whatever defect those first ones had. I don't know if it's inevitable for all feet to turn to mush or not. But I think it's what I actually would like would be something with these exact measurements made from, like, new rubber.
Right. Or maybe just even made from, you know, plastic. Yeah. Maybe plastic with a bit of a texture on it. You know, I mean, I think most people probably are not in situations where your big, heavy retro computer is really at risk of sliding off of the desk you have it sitting on.
Mm-hmm.
I would often rather be able to have something that I could slide around a desk a little bit without having to lift it as much, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of rubber feet all the time. Like, it's a thin line. Like, I'd rather something that is a bit slidier than rubber.
Yeah. I guess it's probably both for, like, protecting the surface and for keeping it anchored.
Right.
Yeah,
but I mean, if you have something that is relatively soft plastic, so that it's not going to, you know, hopefully it's not going to damage, you know, any kind of tender surface.
Right.
I don't know. There's got to be something.
Anyway, yeah, that was sort of interesting to ponder. Because I have definitely found in my office, you know, feet on the ground and thought, ah, geez, like, what did those come from? Where is that from? You know, I could tell it was some Apple thing.
But, right. Well, actually, Paul, your next item actually answers the question of what else besides rubber you could use.
Right, right. I'm not sure what it is about feet. It seems like there was just a bunch. I wasn't searching for feet, I promise. But nevertheless, someone is also selling IBM 5150, 5160, 5170 cork feet, unused condition. And I think if any of you have, like, looked at the bottom of an IBM PC, you'll know what these are. There's something that's sort of kind of iconic, I feel, about these, like, dumb cork, you know, circles that they put at the bottom of the IBM 5150s. But
right.
So these are, I guess, it says used condition. So again, I wonder, like, couldn't somebody make new cork circles?
Right.
But
it's just cork.
Yeah. But anyway, if you want one that somebody at IBM actually touched, here are some replacement ones. And I think they do fall off, you know, so or get broken up or something. So it's probably useful. But yeah, I think you're right, though, that these might be a relatively good replacement. You know, if you could make a little cork, you know, whatever. What shape is that? Like an extruded rectangle. What should I call that?
A semi-cube.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like maybe, you know, if you just cut out, you know, buy like some sort of half-inch thick sheet of cork and cut out little pieces as you need it, you'd have your feet for life.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, and of course, these things, cork will fall apart over time. It's going to crumble and stuff. It's not going to smear. It's not going to sort of like turn. It's not going to turn into its primordial goop form.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, IBM did do that correctly. Oh, speaking of that, well, I'll speak of that later. Speaking of IBM doing things correctly. Okay, let's see. The next thing I have was a weird thing. I don't know what I think of this. I think it was interesting. Well, let me say what it is first. It's TI-5859 Module 8 Securities Analysis with Manual and all 15 tabs.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine the demand is super high for this. But if you had a TI-58 or 59 programmable calculator, it had the ability to take these little cartridge things, you know, so there's a little, it kind of looks like a USB thumb drive or something like this,
right,
that you stick in it, and the calculator itself has a little window that you can put in these little things that tell you what the different function keys do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looks like this has several pages. What did it say? 15 tabs. So yeah, so I guess it must have 3 pages of these little instruction things that you can slide into your calculator, and then I guess all of the software is on the little thing that you insert. And I thought it's kind of interesting to see this. First of all, this is copyright 1978, you know, so it's pretty old. And I guess partly just because I'm not that much of a calculator head, I don't really know, you know, like what these things are normally like. But I bet there really aren't too many of that particular thing. Imagine that most of the securities analysis little booklets are long, long gone.
Right.
So on Wikipedia, you can see what a TI-59 looks like. And it looks like what I think of as a pretty standard TI calculator of the 80s, right? I haven't yet quite gone down the calculator rabbit hole.
No.
Things that can run basic, I'm still kind of on board with, but... Actually, the next thing is a calculator, too, so I don't know what I'm saying, but I think partly what I like about them is they're small, and I don't have any space.
So. So much easier to have a gigantic calculator collection, because it can fit inside of, like, a desk.
Yeah. The next thing I had was a Casio FX-820 computer in the box, and so part of what I liked about it was the box. You know, it says FX-820P personal computer, and so one thing that's cool about it is it has a little printer built in.
Yep. Nice. And the printer, I think, is showing a printout of a basic program, looks like.
Yeah, well, so right, I think I have some cousin of this, which does have a basic that you can use, and it has the same kind of connector, and I think the same can take the same kind of RAM as well, but it doesn't have the printer built in. And it has the arrangement of the display is slightly different. And actually, I think it's prettier. But this one is you know, it's, I don't know, there's a little bit of color of the labels of the, like, the go-to and the four and, you know, arctangent and stuff like this. But anyway, I thought it was partly interesting just because I hadn't come across this model before. But it is basic programmable. It has a printer. So did you say that it was actually a... It had successfully printed something?
Well, it looks like the picture on the box.
Yeah.
Yeah, not the actual one being sold, but the picture on the box shows a printout. What I wonder is, what does this have for storage? Like, if you write your basic program, what can you do with this?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, like, so one thing I do know is that there's a port in the back that you can connect to something that would let you store things on tape.
Okay.
One of the retro challenges that I started long, long ago was, I wonder if I can find this quickly, Yesterbits Casio. So I guess this tells me that the one that I have is an FX-730P. So I don't know if that was what I had said. It might well be. But so I had wanted to basically set up some sort of thing that would allow me to read, possibly with a Raspberry Pi or something, like read and write through that port. So I did look up a little bit about, like, what the pins do, and I played around a little bit with the Raspberry Pi trying to read the pins and connect things together. And then, so this was January 2013.
Okay.
And basically I got 15% of the way there.
Yeah. That's the way it goes sometimes.
next thing is so this I think the seller actually has a bunch of this stuff, but the thing that I'm linking to here, it says UNIVAC and IBM 360 vintage computer manuals. The if you read the description on this, it comes from a lifelong employee of UNIVAC, IBM, Sperry, Remington Rand, you know, big iron computer companies.
Right.
You know, I assume that this is some kind of an estate sale or an estate disposition of some kind. But someone who kept a lot of this documentation, and so it's relatively well kept binders of stuff about the UNIVAC, and there's some other stuff that relates to the IBM 360. It's pretty wild to see all this stuff. It'd be interesting to look at. I couldn't bring myself to think that I, you know, I would be the person to take and scan it, and you know, I'm kind of hoping that someone takes and scans it. But it is this particular lot has a starting bid of $900. You could buy it for $1,500 if you felt so inclined.
Right.
I imagine not many people feel so inclined, but it is interesting to look at this.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. It seems like, yeah, it seems like this is a very specialist thing that someone would want to pay that amount of money for this. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And, I mean, I guess, I don't know what I think of it. I mean, like, I definitely think that, you know, someone who has kept this stuff safe for that long and thought ahead to know that it sort of should be saved, it's reasonable to be compensated for that. You know, it sort of feels like the kind of thing that should be donated, and yet at the same time, I feel like it's okay for someone to get credit for having kept it to the point of giving it to somebody like a museum.
Mm.
But
sure.
At the same time, I don't know if that's what's happening here. I mean, like, yeah. it's often could be the case that what's happening here is like someone went to a estate sale and grabbed a bunch of stuff that looked old.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that $1,500 worth of credit is due on that.
Right.
Maybe some. I mean, you know, someone knew what it was. So anyway, interesting to see.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of similarly interesting to see, there's someone who's got a bunch of Radio Shack catalogs from the time when they were selling, you know, Model 3s and 4s and stuff like that.
Mm.
They're pretty cool. And this is a starting bid has been put down, but it is $2. So, I mean, it'll go for what it goes for. But They look nice. I suspect they're scanned out there, you know, like if you really wanted to read the contents, but kind of pleasing to be able to hold them.
Right. Yeah, obviously it's different when you have the actual paper in front of you.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, let's see. Wow. Oh, this got bid up way beyond. when I put it in this list, there hadn't been any bids, I don't think. But
okay.
So the next thing I have is a unopened 20th anniversary Macintosh Newman box. So it is basically a pretty good-looking, taped-up, heavy box that allegedly
that
contains...
might have a computer in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was the thing I was not, like, I kind of wanted to just say about this one. The 20th anniversary of Macintosh itself, even in not fantastic condition, tends to go for quite a lot. I mean, like, I don't have one because they are expensive. They didn't make a lot of them. You know, they're sort of, you know, so they were, it's kind of designed to be a collectible thing to begin with.
Right.
So, and if you're lucky, you can get one with the box. And if you're luckier still, you can, you know, get one with the box where the connection to the separate bass speaker hasn't frayed out and started buzzing, because I think there's a sort of common problem with these.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. I mean, it's kind of cool to be able to just open one as if you just bought it. But it's already hit. It's over $1,000 with 11 bids, and there's 9 days left.
But what do these cost new? They cost a fortune, right?
I think so.
These cost multiple thousands of dollars when they were new.
Yeah.
I'm sure. I've only seen one of these once. At a company I worked at a decade or more ago, there was a guy who had one, who had it in the office for some amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was even using it. I don't even, I'm not sure why he even had it in the office, but I remember seeing it, and it looked cool, but I never actually did anything with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting design. It's weird. If you haven't seen them, it's kind of like a vertical design, and the bottom half is like the CD drive.
Right.
Which actually that worries me a little bit too, that I imagine that probably breaks relatively frequently. Like the hinge on the door.
Right.
But the gray is a lot like the, and it's sort of like the PowerBooks, or like the CD player. So I don't know, they're neat, but they're kind of trophies.
Yeah. The thing with this vertical CD drive, and actually the whole Liquid, it kind of makes me think of like a Bang & Olufsen integrated stereo or something. You know what I mean? It's like this sort of like weird, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think that was, it was supposed to fit in your posh apartment.
Right.
I mean, it was very specifically luxurious, right? I mean, it's, you're paying a premium for the design.
Right.
So we'll see where this goes. I was just noticing that the shipping to me from where it is in California is listed as being $230 by itself.
Ooh, damn. So,
but I guess, I mean, in this situation, you really don't want this to be like messed up in shipping.
True.
but what do you do? Like, so then there's this question, like, is the point of this to have the experience of opening it new, or is this, are you just going to just keep it sealed in your own closet?
Yeah.
So, and I don't, another thing I don't know about this is whether this is particularly one that is, well, there's two problems, two potential problems. One, does it have a battery in it?
Mm-hmm.
And two, does it have the capacitors of the era that all need to be replaced? You know, because it could be that even, you know, minty fresh in the box, the thing's all corroded to heck.
Right.
So, yep. Anyway, interesting to see.
Yeah, we'll see. Interesting.
Okay. Last thing. Well, basically, last thing. You know, so in the searching that I did, I came up with the, I came across a retro S100 Altair 8800 computer Arduino clone. So what this is, you know, as it says, it's basically based on an Arduino Due. And the relevant part is that it's a green sort of like circuit board thing with a bunch of LEDs on it, little switches on it. It's not even trying to look exactly like an Altair 8800, but it has all the pieces that you need. So it has little switches and to allow you to program it. And it has like a little SD card and it's connected to, you know, an actual sort of modern Arduino in the back.
Right.
It's pretty interesting. It's $175 buy it now, shipping from Thailand.
Okay.
I assume that this is one of several, although there's just one on offer at the moment, but it looks like a project that is intended to be replicated.
Right. Well, I just pasted in here, Paul, a very similar thing that I just happened to see a few minutes ago.
Huh?
That's similar in concept, but even smaller. It's a very, very tiny, tiny Altair 8800 clone type of thing.
Well, is it by the same seller in Thailand?
Perchance? Yes, it is.
I think it might be. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, yeah, I did want to mention that too, because this is the one that you found was the one I was actually going to link to first, and then I just thought...
Oh, okay. But the one you mentioned, it has. I think it has nicer switches.
Yeah.
You can actually use it with your fingers. The one I'm mentioning, it's has tiny, like those tiny dip switches you can have on a thing on a motherboard, but it's not really something you'd have to poke it with a device. You can't adjust with your fingers.
Right. The little one is $105 by it now. So it's somehow, at least for me, there's a pretty big psychological difference between those two numbers, 175
right.
and 105.
Right.
I think this little one is pretty cool, but it would be horrible to use.
Right. Because yeah, the usability is terrible.
I hate the dip switches. I hate dip switches anyway. And
yeah.
Like the way that you're supposed to use this, I mean, like maybe this isn't the way you're supposed to use this. but you just couldn't possibly be like toggling in a bootloader.
No, really not. Unless you had mouse size fingers.
Yeah. Well, right, but I mean, but still like human size strength.
Right. Yeah.
So it's cool, but
unusable.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both interesting. I definitely the one that you mentioned first is a lot more usable. I think I really like the crisp little tight LEDs on the small one though. But
yeah. So if there could be a $140 one or whatever sort of in between. yeah, because it's like so basically the bigger one has individual LEDs rather than a kind of like, I don't know what those are, but a little LED block. Anyway. Interesting project.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
And. So, and I think they probably both say this, but they come with a micro SD card that comes preloaded with CPM 2.2, Zork, and MS Basic. And so, you don't have to operate it with the switches. You know, you can use the serial connection.
Sure.
And then one always wonders, well, okay, so how is this different from running an emulator on my computer? I sort of think sometimes these projects are, what's interesting about them is the doing of them and not necessarily of the having the one someone else did.
Yeah.
But it's still pretty cool.
True. Yep.
So I guess we're at the closing discussion point. So what would you like to close with?
Oh, I don't really have anything. I've just been preoccupied with other stuff in my life for the most part, but that's it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not that that's untrue of me, but,
yeah.
So one thing that's pretty cool though, that I came across, I should have finished up the linking of this, but, Ian pointed this out to me. There was a eBay auction that I think was relatively hidden, but like it didn't have relevant keywords in it or something. I forget exactly why it wasn't hitting my searches, but it is a Rochester Data Inc. Dynatyper, and we had talked about this in some previous, like a couple of years ago or something. It showed up in I think it was an ad, because I had scanned Apple Orchard and this was one of the ads for it. But what this Dynatyper is basically a little thing that you put over the keyboard of a Selectric, and it has a bunch of little pegs that will type for you. So you connect it to your computer and it will type on the typewriter.
That's awesome.
Very funny thing. And so I remember thinking like, what a funny thing that this, you know, even exists. And then, so just recently I was able to find one on eBay, which I'm sure never happens.
Right.
But, so I bid and won and got it, and I have it now. I haven't set it up, because actually one thing, I don't have the interface card for it, so I don't have the actual serial connection for it, but along with the stuff that I got were, you know, some photocopied documents. I don't really know how much that's like what people originally got, or whether they're copies of... It's a weird, kind of a weird collection of things, and I will definitely scan it and, you know, figure out some way to make this available, but it does have some kind of like circuit diagrams of how the, because it's also supposed to connect with a TRS-80, so it's got circuit diagram for that and for the Apple II card, and I think there's enough information there to just rebuild it, because the card's pretty basic. So that's, I think that's a very cool thing. I kind of fell down a little rabbit hole on that. And in fact, actually, just recently, Kevin Savitz in his Ted Nelson junk mail, you know, scanning project, unearthed like a brochure for this, and it was a little bit before they'd actually settled on a name, or at least they hadn't settled on the Dynatyper name, so it was called the IOPAC at that point. But it's pretty cool actually to be able to see the marketing materials for this, because there's very little out there about this. This is a who would buy this?
Right.
They advertise pretty heavily, but that's all you can find is ads. So now the question is, the Apple interface, you know, it's like a connector and six chips and like a capacitor or something. It's really like, there's very little going on there.
Sure.
So I think it should be doable.
I mean, it may just be a serial connection that you could attach to almost anything and work it out.
Yeah.
I don't really know.
So anyway, I'm looking forward to playing with that at some point, but I thought it was kind of neat. There was another thing. This came up. Someone had been talking about the similarity between like the Commodore 64 and the TRS-80 Model 1, and like everybody sort of using the same form factor. And I was reminded of this thing, which, you know, so I think it was mentioned at some point in the past, but there's a book in 2013 by Paul Atkinson called Delete, A Design History of Computer Vaporware. And I don't have that book, but there was a photo of sort of like a proposed IBM PC that, you know, somebody scanned it out of this book or took a photo of it, and it sort of hit my consciousness again. And it's a really cool thing. So
I see it right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it clearly looks a lot like an Atari 800.
Yeah. It's this hilarious thing. I mean,
drastically so.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's white. It has very sort of like, IBM typewriter like keys though, like unlike Atari keys, I believe, right? At least to me, they look like a electric typewriter.
Yeah.
But it's got vents on the top. It's kind of a cocoa shape, I suppose. But it
very much has this door.
Right.
There's a door that will open up to reveal some sort of slots inside there.
Surely, right.
Just like an 800.
Yeah.
And what crosses my mind as soon as you started talking about this and I saw this was that I know that at some point, or I remember hearing that Atari went to IBM to pitch the idea of selling this, you know, the 800 as a computer of some kind with IBM. Like there was some, before it was actually released as a product, there was some sort of cross-pollination there.
Yeah, right. So that's, that I think is basically the story behind this. So there was a bit of a discussion on the 6502 Google Plus group, which is also linked here. But yeah, I mean, essentially I think what it was the proposal was that IBM either buy Atari or at least buy this, for it to be the thing they release as the IBM PC. So, so it would have been a 6502 machine, basically an Atari 8-bit.
Right.
Which is a weird feature to think about.
Right.
but the picture's fantastic though. I mean, I really kind of like that computer.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks cool.
So anyway, just as it was neat to see that come up again. I don't know. How does this... So, I don't know how to delineate the different portions of this allegedly organized podcast, because everything is just, like, some retro stuff we came across.
It's okay. That's good. But we're just talking about stuff.
I guess that's true. But I think we're done, actually, talking about stuff at this point. So...
Hey, we did it.
Yes. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. Or, you know, you can also go to Atari Age because that's also got good forums. But I guess maybe I shouldn't have put that in the promote RCR stuff, but I was just reminded that we talked about that, you know, minutes and minutes and minutes ago. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time, Retro Compute.